gentleman that Dwayne Northrup hired, who was the pathologist in the Trayvon Martin case, is what you're talking about.
Because nobody knows about it, because you told me that the News Gazette isn't talking about it at all.
Yeah, I haven't seen any stories about that. They write a lot of stories. Yeah, they like to write a lot of stories about me. But no, this I haven't seen anything. The gentleman who Mr. Northrup hired over there, who basically blamed Trayvon Martin for his own death by saying that he had cannabinoids or had some traces of cannabis in his system, was hired by Dwayne Northrup here. So he's been working here in Champaign County for years.
Incredible.
Since 2013.
And I think he was contracted, so he did not have to go through the approval process of the county board or something like that.
Right.
So, it hasn't gotten much traction.
Well, we're going to keep mentioning it here, and I was hoping to get at least a paragraph or two about it in the upcoming public eye. Yeah, okay, send me his name, and I'll ask him if he wants to write a little short thing or maybe a longer thing later. I brought up the fact that it shows how pernicious privatization is. You know, it's supposed to be a public function, and he can hire this guy who should have a cloud over
his head. Yeah,
his CV,
So they fired him, and Dwayne said, "Hey, you can come work for me in 2013.
You're my guy, I guess." What's up with that? Okay, what's the rundown? Well, did you hear about how Trump tried to get the big pharma to send out $200 cards to senior citizens? And they said, well, we don't think so. That's $8 billion. So now he's raiding the Medicare fund for $8 billion to send out a Trump medical expenses card. It's ridiculous. I'm not hearing enough about it either. I got Sonali Kalatar interviewing somebody from the Institute for Policy Studies on that issue. Got something I haven't done in a while, which is, where are the kids? Is it really 100,000 ICE-detained children? Could it possibly be? I mean, we don't know. And I got two commentaries about the criminal spreader. The criminal super spreader, the super spreader in chief, from Amy Goodman and a colleague of hers, Laura Flanders. She was the voice of Counterspin, the great program on fairness and accuracy in reporting. And whilst doing all this, I'd be happy and pleased. I'm not going to cough. I'm not going to drop any F-bombs like Trump did on his two-hour segment with Rush Limbaugh yesterday. Did you hear about that? He's threatening Iran with visiting on them something that no one has experienced before. If you F word with us, I guess Limbaugh didn't think he needed a tape delay for POTUS, but he was wrong. There's hours and hours of Trump calling into, who's the guy that's on Sirius now? Oh my God, I can't remember. Anyway, shock jock, highest paid one. Yeah, I can't remember his name because I never paid much attention to him. But they're not releasing all that audio. I guess that somebody got a payoff there too, I suppose. Mumia's on the spreader in chief's case too. So why don't we hear him first? I'm a little labored. I took my temperature today. I thought I was running a fever, and I'm actually running lower than I usually do. So I'm going to wear this mask the whole show, just in case. Hope you're feeling well.
Mad as hell. The hospitalization of an American president is a story that pierces every other story in the media. And Trump has played it like he's on Broadway. I can hardly count the guys who've insisted that this is a hoax, that Trump wasn't really sick. I may disagree, but it changes nothing, for he's a man whose heart to believe. Around him, almost a dozen people have fallen ill because of the coronavirus. The United States is awash in COVID-19, and it ain't getting any better. In parts once low in the virus, we've now seen spikes. Trump has ignored it, downplayed it, and likened it to the flu. Downplay it all you want, but this thing is real. And that doesn't mean that this nation isn't sick and getting sicker. Getting through this virus will take time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Yeah, they're going to be three in a row here on the Spreader-in-Chief, like I said. Then we'll get to some machinations of the economic sort. I see economic updates coming up this afternoon. That's, of course, after the new two-hour show. We Do the Work is another show that's going to be on this afternoon. But the trio coming in to do Radio Free Labor are doing some work, getting probably ready right now. So they'll be around at 11 o'clock. I do hope to get a pledge or two, like I will be writing mine out, like was mentioned earlier. I came in a little bit earlier thinking I could handle a call or two. I do play a lot of recorded material. I hope you're listening to it. But if you want to pledge, I always tell people where they can find it. So I guess we have Trump on the balcony today at the White House. It's the Il Duce look, I guess. That works for him, I guess. And super spreader. Here's Amy's breaking the sound barrier commentary.
Donald Trump, super spreader in chief, endangers White House staff. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. As President Trump exited the golden doors of Walter Reed Hospital Monday, a reporter shouted,
"How many of your staff are sick?"
"Thank you very much. Thank
you. Do you think you might be a super spreader, Mr. President?"
Trump ignored him and boarded Marine One to the White House. There, in a bizarre reality show-type display, he marched up to the balcony, waved, saluted, took off his mask, appeared out of breath, then went inside. Trump's defiant removal of his mask threatened the household staff, a majority of whom are older people of color, thus at the greatest risk of serious illness or death from COVID-19. Trump's callous disregard for these workers and the outbreak at the White House overall is a metaphor for his shameful pandemic response, as he denies science, mocks masks and social distancing, and presides over the planet's highest ever-growing national death count. President Trump announced via tweet his and the First Lady Melania Trump's positive COVID-19 test results around 1 a.m. Eastern Time on Friday, October 2nd. Evidence suggests a White House Rose Garden event, an indoor reception the previous Saturday, September 26th, where Trump nominated
Judge Amy Coney Barrett
to the Supreme Court before a crowd of over 200 predominantly unmasked people likely spread the virus. At least 11 people at the event, including Trump, have since tested positive for the coronavirus. On Sunday, Trump's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, announced that the White House would no longer disclose when staff test positive, just one day before she herself tested positive, along with two of her deputies. Also on Monday, the New York Times' Maggie Haberman tweeted, "Two White House resident staff members who tested positive, they work for the housekeeping department. When their tests came back positive, they were told to use discretion in discussing it," she tweeted. When trying to contain a pandemic, discretion is not needed.
aggressive testing, quarantining of those exposed to an infected person, isolation of those who are infected, and contact tracing of those who may have been exposed and should be tested are critical tools to end the pandemic. Dr. Rochelle Walensky of Massachusetts General Hospital shared her concerns about the Rose Garden event at an Infectious Disease Society of America news briefing this Wednesday.
There are over 300 people who work in the White House who might be considered White House essential personnel, who might go home to places where it would be harder to find a test, harder to find quarantine, and who might live in multi-generational households.
The White House, now a COVID-19 hotspot, seems more concerned with controlling the spin than with controlling the spread. So Middlebury College journalist Benji Renton helped create an online White House COVID tracker. Using public reports, pictures, flight manifests, and a tip line, they've identified 327 people linked to Trump in the White House during the past week or two, of whom 35 have tested positive for the coronavirus. They categorize infections by event, including the Amy Coney Barrett announcement, a White House event hosting Gold Star families, and Trump's debate preparation on Sunday, September 27th, the presidential debate in Cleveland on Tuesday, September 29th, a rally in Duluth, Minnesota on Wednesday, September 30th, and a fundraiser at Trump's Bedminster, New Jersey Golf Club on Thursday, October 1st. At all of these events, masks were almost entirely absent. Additionally, all but one of the military's Joint Chiefs of Staff are in quarantine after exposure to a COVID-19 positive admiral. Nature magazine reported that contact tracing all those who Trump may have infected in the seven states he visited in the week leading up to his COVID-19 diagnosis would be massive but very feasible. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy is seeking to contact all 206 attendees at Trump's Bedminster fundraiser, as well as at least 19 of Trump's golf club workers. Wealthy donors and prominent politicians easily access testing and can comfortably quarantine if needed. But what about the workers, those on the front lines of our pandemic response, essential workers keeping the economy going, and those trapped in the White House with a maskless Donald Trump? Ai-Jen Poo, the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, said in a statement, "The outbreak of coronavirus at our highest level of government highlights the urgent need to provide essential worker protections and comprehensive COVID relief for all of us," she said. The White House was built by and later staffed by enslaved people. Racism and white supremacy are built into its walls. Now a dedicated staff of essential workers in the residence, many of them older people of color, cook, clean, provide maintenance, and attend to the first family. President Trump reportedly doesn't wear a mask in the residence. His indifference to those workers and the country at large is criminal and portends a deepening pandemic with many more deaths in the cold, dark months ahead. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, in the very last bit of that commentary, she takes on or points at what Laura Flanders makes even more of in this segment. I may be playing this regularly. I don't know. She's got a commentary. She's actually got a Sunday morning show. I don't watch the chat shows anymore on Create, the channel we know more of for travel and hobbies and painting and stuff. But formerly the voice of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I met her in her homeland. She's Irish, originally, Irish-American now, and there was a radio conference in Dublin, Ireland, that I attended. We took a bus up to the north, went to Stormont Castle, and quite a bit. The only time I've ever had submachine guns trained on the bus I was in. I wasn't like walking and they were training machine guns on me, but I was on a bus that was crossing the border, and there were four, if I remember, two on each side, armed with some kind of Walton submachine gun, I guess it was. I'm not a gun nut, so I don't know. I just made that up because that's what James Bond carried. All right. I think I feel feverish, even though my temperature's low. I guess I'm on the oscillation part. Enough about me. Thanks for listening. We'll try and get these next segments on in their entirety without speeding them up much. Haven't listened to the one with the Pueblo Sin Fronteras guy, interviewed by Flashpoints, flashpoints.net, Dennis Bernstein. I think we'll get to that last. The one I foreshadowed earlier, maybe you people are interested in, the card with apparently your name on it and Trump's name on it for senior citizens. I guess I would qualify for one, though I'm on the state retirement system, so I guess might go out to Social Security people. It's a peculiar country, isn't it? Here's Laura Flanders. This is a commentary called The F Word, which of course is what Trump shared on his two-hour episode with Rush Limbaugh yesterday, proving his stamina or something. Lots of commercial breaks, time to use the atomizer and keep his larynx okay. I'm referring, of course, to when he was on Hannity's show, when Hannity even had the temerity to ask twice if he had been tested negative, which wasn't answered. He actually had to shut off his own mic, mute the mic.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show. Watch us on the World Channel every Sunday at 11:30 a.m. and at our YouTube channel. The show premieres and then syndicates to public television stations. Check your local listings. Prefer to listen? Find us on a local radio station or subscribe to the free podcast at lauraflanders.org. That's where you'll receive my special commentaries. I call them the F word. Here's this week's. Could Donald Trump be charged with a crime for knowingly exposing others to an infectious disease? He could if that disease was hepatitis. If the Donald was a poor man, poorly defended, and in poor health, there's a good chance he'd be facing criminal charges. Under laws that Republicans have enthusiastically backed, if Donald Trump had HIV, he could well be locked up in prison. According to the Center for HIV Law and Policy, 13 states currently have laws on the books that apply stiff penalties to people who expose others to hepatitis. 32 states similarly criminalize people living with HIV, even if there is no intent, no threat, and no disease is actually transmitted. In New Jersey, where the president exposed around 100 people to the deadly coronavirus at a fundraiser held just hours after his advisor Hope Hicks tested positive, exposing a person to HIV is punishable by 3 to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $15,000. Trump's adopted state of Florida has half a dozen HIV criminalization laws on the books, under which 266 people have been convicted. In Pence's Indiana, people living with AIDS can face separate felony charges for every day they fail to disclose their status to their past partners, even if they wear a condom and even if no exposure takes place. The crime is failure to disclose, which the law calls failure to warn. At least 20 people in and around the White House have tested positive for the coronavirus recently who might well have appreciated a presidential warning. This is not to argue that COVID carriers should be incarcerated. Far from it. The data is clear. While institutions like schools and restaurants and airports and the White House have a duty to protect public safety, prosecuting individuals doesn't improve public health, it endangers it. Criminalization discourages the sick and the addicted from seeking help and pushes them further into dangerous situations where it's more likely, not less, that they'll endanger others. But mostly those who fall afoul of those laws aren't presidents, they're poor people with addictions needing treatment. When Vice President Pence was governor of Indiana, he was so attached to getting tough that he missed the chance to prevent an HIV cluster that claimed 215 lives. The hypocrisy in the Trump camp now is exasperating to reformers. Sean Strube, a survivor of AIDS, was elected mayor of Milford, Pennsylvania a few years ago. There's a marvelous new film about his election. When COVID hit, his was the first municipality in the state to advise people to stay home. Residents were angry, but Strube wasn't about to see a repetition of the crisis he'd lived through. Now he's worried about what happens next. The Zero Project, which he also directs, recently joined with other
other AIDS groups from around the world issuing a statement against COVID-19 criminalization. So far, according to the new tracker on the Zero website, the only COVID criminalization bill introduced in the U.S. was sponsored by a Republican state senator, now Congressman Chris Jacobs of New York, whom Donald Trump endorsed twice via Twitter. Jacobs' bill came in response to a story about a Buffalo man spitting on a police officer while being arrested. But back then, things were different. Back then, the Justice Department was warning that malicious coronavirus spreaders could be charged with terrorism, but the people in the crosshairs were immigrants, felons, protesters, and the Chinese. Not a predator president turned super spreader. It's not his DNA of which he's so inordinately proud. It's the DNA of our legal code that protects the dangerous Donald. For more from the Laura Flanders Show, go to lauraflanders.org. Thanks.
Huh, well said. Actually, I was distracted thinking of what I was doing next. Well, I may have enough time for some music from last night's Caribbean Jazz Collective. Afro-Caribbean Jazz Collective, that's it. They had three percussionists. It was brilliant. It's part of the Jazz Festival, CU Jazz Festival, which will have two virtual events, one from Brooklyn this afternoon. Or no, these are both 6 and 8. So you can go look. There might be a link from the WEF site, I'm not sure, to the schedule of events. There's a jazz brunch at Broadway Food Court, which is a big, spacious place where you can wave at people, maybe, be socially distanced, and probably hear some nice chat conversation about music and some music. Janelle of Tuesday morning, right? Monday morning? Monday morning, that's it. All right, that's my cultural feature. Some other great music around outside. It looks like it might be mild enough. Not hot like yesterday. All right, I guess we'll do the economic one first. And I think we should have it right here. This is with Sonali Kolhatkar. She does a daily show, and she'll tell you all about it here in the up front out of KPFK, not WBAI, or actually Amy Goodman has her own facilities now, that's right. BAI is still suffering from, well, they had their antenna on the Twin Towers, and they signed a deal which had this escalator clause, and they're really getting hit hard for antenna expenses. The WEFT has had its antenna expenses, having to move to a different tower and getting an entirely new antenna. How's your contours? Hope you're listening well. Might have some new people in certain districts, I've heard. I'd like to hear from some outlying areas. I always make that pitch since I listen to community radio out of Gaslight Square in St. Louis from a distance. I get a little autobiographical when I'm doing Pledge Drive. Community radio was really important to me coming up in rural southern Illinois. Okay, 359-9338. If you don't know the number, fly WEFT. Actually, we don't. Most people don't have phones that have the letters on them anymore, so maybe some people don't even know what that means. Huh. All right. That's enough for this bit. I promoted Radio Free Labor in now 36 minutes. Oh, I guess. Yeah.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It has been months since the CARES Act expired, leaving millions of unemployed Americans rudderless and with no plan from the federal government to aid them in making ends meet. The Trump administration has flip-flopped repeatedly over supporting an extension to jobless benefits and or a second round of $1,200 stimulus checks, while the Republican Party has remained in limbo, unsure of what their president actually wants. The House of Representatives has already passed a new $2.2 trillion bill to continue benefits, but with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell more interested in packing the courts with conservatives instead of ensuring families survive, there's little chance it will pass. Trump, who has been revealed to have paid little to nothing in taxes, has benefited from socialized medicine at Walter Reed Hospital and $100,000 worth of cutting-edge treatments for his coronavirus affliction. He's now dipping into the Medicare Trust Fund to send $200 drug discount cards with his name on it to older voters ahead of the election. I'm joined now by Karen Dolan, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the project director of their Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project. Welcome to the program, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So before we get into this crazy plan to scramble to send drug discount cards to elderly, you know, folks, to seniors and voters, let's talk about the broader context of how we have a president and a party who has really, you know, seemed to tell Americans you're on your own after the CARES Act expired, and, you know, even the PPP loans have dried up. Does the country really have an actual plan for what people who've lost jobs or are struggling because of the pandemic, for what they can do?
Currently, there is no plan. So there is no plan that's agreed to or even taken up by the Republican-controlled Senate. And as we know, erratically, recently, President Trump stopped all negotiations between the White House and the House leadership, as well as between the House leadership and any potential negotiations with the Senate. The White House had been in constant recent communication with House Speaker Pelosi on yet a second HEROES Act that the House had passed, and nothing had been done. The first one was passed all the way back in May to help keep Americans going through the expiration of the CARES Act, but the Senate refused to take it up, so did the White House. And it's only recently the White House reengaged through Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, but President Trump took a abrupt halt, ordered a halt to those negotiations, and then did a backflip on that somewhat when the stock market took a deep dive in response to that strange news. So currently there is no safety net, there is no relief for the millions of Americans that are suffering.
I mean, it's just quite remarkable. And some of this, you know, these details that we've just been talking about may change in the next few days. We really don't know. The other part of it is that we know that the economy needs an infusion of cash, right? We have, unfortunately, a consumer-based economy. And so when money was put into people's pockets, they spent it, even more than the $1,200 stimulus payments. Wasn't there information from economists that showed that unemployed Americans who got that $600 of benefits in the CARES Act spent much of it, and it was a boon to the economy? I mean, it buoyed businesses.
Well, that's right. So because both the House and the Senate did act rather swiftly in March and passed what we call the CARES Act, that was able to keep both small businesses and families and people afloat as the economy closed down. And what's really interesting about that is because of that aid and because of the fact that we had gone into the pandemic with such a wide inequality and such structural poverty, that extra aid, even though it was a few more hundred dollars in people's pockets, that actually, the poverty rate ticked down at the beginning of the pandemic because government assistance that should have always been there in absence of real structural change, that was there to provide a safety net for people, and it also was a boon to the economy. But as soon as the CARES Act provisions ran out, you saw just terrible hardship come rushing back. Small businesses closing, restaurants closing permanently. You know, millions of people who had lost their jobs, only half of which have come back, and people falling back lower, deeper into poverty, and also experiencing food insecurity. So that we have one in three children in this United States of America, 1 in 3 children living in families that are either food insecure or housing insecure. So it's a very precarious situation, and this has been allowed to go on for months.
Now, meanwhile, the Trump administration, as I mentioned earlier, is moving to put money of a tie of some sort into the hands of a very specific demographic. Politico reported, based on documents that they obtained, that the Trump administration has ordered its agencies to scramble to send $200 drug discount cards to seniors to help pay for medication. And they're using $8 billion from the Medicare trust funds to do so. And they want it before November 3rd. There are a number of polls showing Trump is struggling with the demographic that Republicans have traditionally relied on, that the senior voters are sort of evenly split between Joe Biden and Trump. And this just seems like a very thinly veiled attempt to win over votes because he wants his name on those discount cards. Karen, what is this? Has this even been done before, this sort of thing?
No, and it's very, it's a very dubious proposition legally. There doesn't seem to be a legal basis for it, nor a way to pay for it. So initially, this was a scheme hatched up by Trump and Mark Meadows and some White House officials to have pharmaceutical companies pay for this campaign scheme. And Big Pharma balked at the idea of paying for a campaign stunt, and especially one that doesn't change the structural problems or produce a long-term solution for the crisis of high drug prices, especially for seniors in this country. So what the administration was left with doing is to rob Peter to pay Paul and to take almost, as you say, $8 billion out of the Medicare trust fund, which is something that the head of the Medicare and Medicaid services, who's behind this now, had said that she would never do. It's a highly unsound practice. And it's not clear that there's legal justification that they are trying to fit this into a waiver about testing whether or not seniors will take their drugs more readily if they have this Trump gift card in their pocket.
It's quite incredible to see this. They want his name on it. They want it by election day. There's not even an attempt to make it appear as though it's not political. And most importantly, this is tax money, right? These are tax dollars paid for by all of us. I mean, the Medicare Trust Fund presumably is funded by tax dollars.
That's right. And the Medicare Trust Fund actually is even in a worse position right now because Trump also passed by fiat that government workers would not pay payroll taxes till the end of this year. And that, of course, is what funds the Medicare trust fund. So we're really in risky territory right now. And this is supposed to, one, as you say, appeal to seniors who he has lost. He's down by 27% in polls of senior support, which he had in 2016. So he's desperate to regain senior voters. And also, we're in the, he had made a promise to lower prescription drug costs. He was not able to get a plan passed for that. And at the same time, he has tried vigorously to end the Affordable Care Act, now with the Supreme Court actually hearing that case with a strongly conservative court in November. So we're in a very precarious position, not to mention we're in the middle of a pandemic. So there's no way in which this can be viewed as anything other than a blatant political stunt, campaign stunt, that does nothing but hurt seniors and all of us.
And didn't Trump promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act? We've been told now for 4 years that he's going to have this great plan. He has a plan. It's coming. It's going to be unveiled. And here we are 4 years after his first election. And where's the plan? He was asked about it at the debate. His vice president was asked about it at the debate. They did not have good answers for it. It seems as though he's just trying to rebrand the remnants of the Affordable Care Act as Trump Care.
Well, that's right. So he has vaguely some sign that says America First Health Plan, and this campaign scheme of a $200 Trump card in the pockets of some seniors, which, by the way, will cost over 50 million just to produce, and another 20 million to distribute letters telling about them being produced. Wow. So just think about the cost of this stunt beyond even the $200 cards. And also, Trump, you may remember, in September passed a very puzzling executive order declaring that pre-existing conditions will not be a barrier to health coverage, neglecting to say that we already have the law of the land, the Affordable Care Act, already accomplishes that. So the very health law that he is dismantling already has the provision that pre-existing conditions will not be a barrier to health coverage, whereas his executive order has no legal standing. There's no way to enforce that. That also needs congressional action. And we have an existing law already on the books that provides for that, which he's dismantling. It's a very, there's no way to make sense of it.
So little makes sense these days. And of course, coming just before that debate and right after he signed that executive order was the New York Times reporting on his own taxes, which I feel like needs to be part of this conversation, because you and I pay taxes into the Treasury, but our laws have been written for billionaires like Trump to pay disproportionately fewer taxes. The tax reform bill, that so-called reform bill that he signed into law with the Republicans, made it easier for billionaires to get write-offs and save money. And now we know that in the first 2 years of his presidency, he paid $750 in tax. Meanwhile, as president, he has used so much of our tax dollars for security for his golf trips, and now, of course, gotten treatment at a top government-funded, taxpayer-funded hospital with cutting-edge experimental drugs. And that treatment, we are seeing reports, have cost $100,000 of American tax dollars, which, of course, is likely not available to the rest of us if we catch COVID, right? Like, this needs to be part of the conversation, I feel.
That's an extremely important point. So, essentially, Trump is alive because of our taxpayer dollars, because of a socialized medicine plan that is not available to us, medications that aren't available to us, and care for which he has not contributed. In 10 of the last 15 years, he's not paid a dime in taxes. And as you said, last year, only 750. So this is a real deep inequity. And at the same time, as you mentioned, billionaires have actually gotten richer during the pandemic. So the people who are in the best position have just gotten more secure, while the rest of us have been plunged into deeper instability. So the wide inequalities, racial inequalities, gender inequalities, inequalities that hurt transgender people, mothers, children, these gaps of inequality have just become gaping chasms. And Trump has certainly benefited personally from these kinds of inequalities. And in a way that's, I don't know how to describe it other than cruel, except that it is just a sheer power grab, denying this kind of stability to the rest of us.
And he's told us not to be afraid of the coronavirus, because, of course, the message that has been given to us all along is wear your mask or don't wear your mask, you know, socially distance or not, go to school, whether it's safe or not, open your businesses, whether it's safe or not. So all of that is consistent with Trump's cavalier attitude toward a disease that has now killed well over 200,000 Americans. Now, going back to the fact that the federal government and the Republican-controlled Senate has essentially abandoned the economy as it is for ordinary people, there's discussion around whether or not to have unemployment benefits or whether or not to have the $1,200 stimulus checks. But what about state budgets? Is there any discussion to fill the massive and yawning gaps for state budgets that are opening up because revenue is drying up due to the pandemic, which, you know, this is money, I imagine, that public health and safety that the state funds relies on?
That's exactly right. So the Democratic House proposals, again, the first HEROES Act passed the House back in May, and the second one in September, both of which the Republican-controlled Senate has not agreed to take up, they did provide funding, critically needed funding, for state and local governments. State and local governments fund education, teachers, first responders, healthcare, any number of services that are critical for our health and well-being of our children, our families, our education system, and those have just been decimated. And it's really unconscionable to understand that that's one of the major reasons that Trump is opposed to a relief package, because it would go to fund teachers and first responders and critical services in any state which happens to have a Democratic governor. And when you think about the implications of that politicizing just our basic needs, it's hard to understand.
Right. So we have a situation now where Americans are struggling. There's an election coming. The aid to Americans appears to be based on a political, how it might politically benefit Trump. That's all part of it. The Democrats only have so much power because they only control the House and can't actually get any legislation passed. And so much depends on this election. And I'm wondering, Karen, if you think that Americans are aware, because we're also awash in misinformation, and we have at the head of the nation a master manipulator, a master propagandist. All of the issues that you and I are discussing, are they apparent to Americans who support Trump, or do they just believe what he says when he tells them that he is going to make sure their pre-existing conditions aren't a cause for discrimination, that it's because of him that they might get a drug discount card, and that, you know, the awareness of the hypocrisy from the Trump administration, from the Republican Party, seems to not be as well covered as we might like. I mean, even though Trump is trailing in the polls, the fact that he has any support at all at this point is shocking.
I think that's right. I do think that his support is his support, and they are not going to move regardless of what he does, regardless of how many loved ones they lose to the virus or to hunger or to homelessness. And I think that that's true. I think it's also true that the majority, the strong majority of people in this country do see the cruel nature of his policies. And I'm not saying this from the perspective of partisanship. The Institute for Policy Studies is nonpartisan. I'm saying it from the position of good policy, just policy, respect for human life and decency. And I think most of the American people can see that those are lacking in the policies coming out of this White House and the relief packages being blocked by the Senate or ignored by the Senate. So for those who are able to look objectively at what's happening, I think that it is clear to them. And don't forget that over 210,000 American lives have been lost in this country, over a million around the world. And we all, I believe most of us, know somebody who's either been infected, sickened, or died from this virus. And it's a very serious public health concern, not to mention that all of our lives have been upended. And we have about half of Americans reporting a significant financial hardship as a result of the pandemic, either health-related or economy-related. So this is very prevalent. People understand it on a deep level. And I believe that most people in this country do see that the policies from the White House have only made this crisis worse.
Karen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the Institute for Policy Studies' website from our site. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Sanaa. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Karen Dolan, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also the project director of their Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project. We've been discussing how Trump is refusing to act to help Americans through the economic impact of the pandemic. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Yeah, Institute for Policy Studies. Oh, I promised I was going to wear my mask the whole show. We're going to go right on. I want to thank our dollar a day donor. And I told him if he wants to give more, he might be inspired to give more. Stuart Levy, he can look into the payroll deduction because I know he works for the U of I. Some other places also do payroll deduction. There's usually a big campaign in the fall, which we are in, but I guess it's another COVID. But I think if you are working, even if you were working remotely, you can probably arrange to do payroll deduction, maybe give more. He called when Ken Green was on the line with me. This is the first time in a long time I've had two donors calling in at the same time. Ken out in Saybrook. I did make a special plea for outlying districts, and I'll reiterate that. Got to catch up with him a little bit. I hung up to take the other calls, so if he wants to call back for the end of the show. But he's on file. He's a great donor. He wants the new T-shirt. I looked at the WEFT page to see if there was a link to CU Jazz Festival. It may be there. I just can't find it. But I should mention that tomorrow there is a virtual WEFT Fest. I think, is there a click-through on this to find out more details? 3 to 6 tomorrow. I think it will be video and audio. Well, we're not going to go into video in a big way. I don't think. The Prairie Monk has a video of his show, this conversation, that goes up on UPTV. Next time I'll be in, if I don't come down for the virtual show, which I probably won't, will be the Urbana, University YMCA's Friday Forum rebroadcast. We do the audio of it. It's now a Zoom. And the Zoom document is at Urbana Public Television. Ibrahim is now the guy working on that. He's very punctual in getting me the audio, but the video is probably already available on demand if you want to look at that. I can't remember the guy's name, I can't remember the speaker's name. I actually don't know if it's a man or a woman, but it's a person from the Champaign County Bailout Coalition who are bailing people out of the jail. I just heard that there may be a COVID case or two in the jail. This is not substantiated yet, but there's people working on it to find out about details of same. And anyway, so tomorrow between 3 and 6, there'll be some live music and maybe some more requests for you to call and donate. People down here answering the phone. All right. I probably won't get the next segment on in its entirety, but if you want to go to flashpoints.net and look for the discussion about, I put it down as ICE and children, but it's predicated on the release of this Inspector General's report. Pretty damning. Inspector Generals, I guess maybe he'll fire that guy too. We had a series of Inspector Generals relieved of duties when they do their duty and report stuff that the Trump administration doesn't like. And this is also the case in this interview with a guy whose name I didn't commit to memory from Pueblos Sin Fronteros, People Without Borders. Remember the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, if you don't remember it, settled the Mexican-American War, allowed for free crossing of the border. So another broken treaty, along with all the Native American treaties.
Out Trump's orders. Rod Rosenstein, is now revealed, called for the prosecution of the children, essentially, who were still breastfeeding. What happened to these children? They were separated from their parents. This administration said they wouldn't even give them toothpaste or a toothbrush. They were separated from their parents, tens of thousands of children, and put into cages. Where are they? And there could be a lot more. What happened? What happens in these private prisons to kids and to families? What has been going on? This report is very troubling. There's a report on this Inspector General's report in the New York Times. You should read that, and you should follow up on this. We've been trying to do it. Joining us to talk a little bit about this and also what's been going on in these private prisons is Alex Mensing. He's with Pueblo Sin Frontera. Alex, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much for having me on, Dennis, and hello to all your listeners.
Well, it's good to have you with us. It was terrible to read about this in the New York Times, but I bet you weren't surprised.
Unfortunately, not at all surprised. I mean, from the time when Jeff Sessions announced zero tolerance back in 2018 and the tone of voice that he had as he talked about needing to crack down on what, unfortunately, the administration with its white supremacist advisors talk about as an invasion. It's not at all surprising to see this kind of thing. One, because we know that their policy of family separation is meant to terrorize immigrant families. And two, because we've seen time and time again that DHS lies. They lie about what they do. They lie about what they said before about what they did. They lie about why they're doing it. And so seeing this kind of report that shows that they knew and that they intended for children, for example, as young as 4 months old to be ripped out of the arms of their parents at the border, it's not surprising to see this kind of pressure coming from the top for people on the ground in Border Patrol to be taking people's kids away. I think
extremely troubling. Go on.
Yeah, looking back, I mean, this started in earnest, the policy that then kind of was recognized as the family separation policy back in November of 2017, when a migrant caravan that Pueblos Sin Fronteras accompanied from Tapachula in southern Mexico to Tijuana, there were four fathers, as one of them who was part of the caravan turned himself in to seek asylum, to turn himself in at the border, the San Ysidro, Tijuana border, to seek asylum. And he turned himself in with his one-year-old son. And it was not 2 days later that he was able to finally call us and tell us that his son was taken away from him. And at first, I wasn't sure when I got that call that I was understanding correctly, if they were just in different rooms, until he said no. And me and three other fathers, there were four fathers who had little children taken away from them, and they were told that if they didn't let them take them away, they would never see them again, that they would take the custody away from them, that they would have to be deported, that they would lose their asylum cases. They were intimidated because they didn't just roll over and let them take them away. They tried to keep them with them, but they were torn away from them, literally torn away from them. And that is not, sometimes people think that the language tearing children from the arms of their parents is exaggerating. That is not an exaggeration. That is literally, physically what happened. And that was back in 2017. And so, unfortunately, when they upped the pressure and decided to terrorize families and rip them apart, it's not at all surprising to see these statements coming out. And I think it confirms that the immigration policy of the United States is off the rails. It is a racist immigration policy that absolutely is designed to cause harm, irreparable harm. And when we talk about irreparable harm, that one-year-old of that father, after he was finally able to get back into the arms of his mother, who then came to try to get him out of this horrible, lice-infested facility run by the government where he had been taken, he didn't recognize his parents. And then when his father, who had had this child separated from him, was left inside Otay Mesa ICE prison for months and months and months, they went, even on Father's Day, they went to go try to see him, and they were denied the ability to see their father, who was being locked up in an ICE prison. So it goes way beyond just the horrible moment of being separated, of having a child ripped away, which I'm sure anyone who's a parent just can't even imagine the pain involved in that. But the trauma that remains for these kids, that's something that nobody's ever going to be able to fully heal. And it's absolutely urgent that people keep that in mind as we look forward in the next months to what's going to happen with the future of leadership, and stay vigilant, because we know that it's not just because of Trump that this is happening. All deportations are family separation. And Obama was the deporter in chief. Jeff Sessions is one of the engineers of this horrible family separation policy. And we have to keep in mind that any of that can continue happening. I want to briefly recognize that, you know, the question about what has happened to these children, where are they, what's going on? There are still families who were separated during 2018 who haven't been able to reunite, because in some cases their parents were deported while their children were still in these government cages. And Adoptado, for example, is an organization that has been working to reunite some parents, but there's just thousands of people who haven't been able to reunite, and those families are suffering through just an unimaginable pain that needs to be stopped.
Unimaginable pain. It is an amazing tens of thousands of children, and you have in this time story the Deputy Attorney General say, take them away. I don't care how young they are, just take them away. I don't care if they're breastfeeding, take them away. It's just, I mean, you've seen this policy and its many facets. You've been somebody who's been a refugee rights representative for yourself, ends up getting detained and arrested and brought into small rooms and questioned about your human rights work. Imagine, and you know your rights, and you're fighting for other people's rights. Imagine what these folks are doing to people. You don't have to imagine, because you've been in the middle of that. Why don't you talk about the multiple struggles you've been having and the kind of work you've been doing to try and deal with some of the atrocities going on in these private prisons, these ICE prisons, that are a part of this very brutal, really Nazi-like policies.
Yeah. So Recently in California, something that I want to talk about is the work that a lot of organizations and groups coming together, one kind of coalition calling themselves the California Liberation Collective that we've been collaborating with, just yesterday held a statewide banner drop. And the purpose of this statewide action is to call on Governor Gavin Newsom to stop being silent and stop being inactive on the question of COVID-19 in ICE prisons, in jails, county jails, prisons all over the state, where despite the fact that Gavin Newsom likes to paint himself as a pro-immigrant liberal who is in favor of racial justice, he has looked the other way while incarcerated communities, including people in ICE prison who we at Coalition for Fairness have been in communication with, he's allowed them to contract COVID-19. He has allowed people to continue to be handed over to ICE when they are released from state prison, like what happened with a wild refugee, Tao Se Lee, recently, after serving. In fact, that case is really emblematic because he actually fought as a firefighter while incarcerated for years. As we know, they get paid slave wages to fight fires in California, which is an essential service. And the way that Governor Newsom repays that is to hand him over to ICE when he's finished serving his sentence. And so we held this action all over the state, more than 30 places, dropped banners. We renamed the Otay Mesa Detention Center the Gavin Newsom COVID-19 Death Camp, was one of the actions that we participated in yesterday. And that's because part of this state violence against refugees and immigrants and all over the United States is just allowing their bodies to be subjected to violence while they are in these detention centers, these ICE prisons. We saw that with the forced gynecological procedures at Irwin County in Georgia, and here at Otay Mesa in San Diego along the border, being exposed to COVID-19, resulting in the death, for example, here at Otay Mesa of Carlos Escobar, who did not receive adequate medical treatment. That's part of what we're fighting against. And so ICE transfers are spreading COVID. Lack of accountability for private prisons is killing refugees and migrants. The continued expansion of private prisons in the state of California, despite the passing last year of AB 32, which was supposed to halt that. These are all things that Gavin Newsom can act on. A lot of people say, well, you know, it's ICE, it's a federal government issue, so what can Governor Gavin Newsom do? But that is not true. He does have control. We saw recently with Nayeli Pena Arce, who is a woman who was finished serving her sentence and we were worried she was going to be turned over to ICE, and due to community pressure, that didn't happen. So we know it's possible. We know there's alternatives. And we know that Governor Gavin Newsom has the power to continue either locking these people up or to actually take action and implement mass clemency for people who would be better off in terms of public safety, at home, social distancing, rather than being in these focal points of infection, of COVID-19 infection, which are jails and prisons and detention centers, and then spreading that all around the state and throughout our communities and to other places. And as a result of a lot of this work, there's an update actually that I'd love to share in a case where another Coalition for Fairness member and I, along with Anna Adlerstein, are suing the federal government because of repeated detention and interrogation, and in Anna's case, arrest, because of our accompanied work of asylum seekers. In Jeff and I's case, for accompanying the caravans, we started getting sent to secondary inspection every time we crossed the border, taken into interrogation cells. Jeff had his cell phone taken and looked at by Border Patrol officials. Anna was arrested. And so all of this retaliation, we did hear just last week that this federal lawsuit that the ACLU of Southern California is taking on our behalf is going to go forward. The government filed a motion to dismiss it. The federal government's always going to say everything we do is peachy and rosy and doesn't violate any laws, but we know that that's not true. And this case is going to move forward. The judge in Tucson denied that motion to dismiss, and so we're really glad about that. And that sets a good decision, a good order about the fact that the government, just because it's at the border, just because Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection think that they can do whatever they want, that that's not true, and that they do have to respect the Constitution. And we know that the Constitution isn't the end-all, be-all of human rights, but it's a tool that we're glad is working to be able to move forward with this case.
Yeah, the Constitution is not a be-all, end-all for human rights, that's for sure. Only a couple of minutes left. I suggested I was maybe going to put a little of the Jazz Festival, CU Jazz Fest. There'll be some virtual events, but now my device isn't working. Oh, well, that's not very musical. Best laid plans go astray, and the ones that are off the hook are even worse. You know, hush your mouth. Let's just go right to the underwriting announcement and then disclaim this. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And that sounds pretty good. We need a disc here too, Mr. Bob.
Didn't I give you one?
Oh, did you?
Urbana Park District facilities are open, and the Park District is slowly restarting its programs. Please visit www.urbanaparks.org for more information.